Smith.
And I'm Travis Barker.
And you're watching the Bicons podcast. Ding, ding, ding. Welcome back. We're back. Wow. We have a different uploading schedule. We will be uploading once a month now, right?
For a regular episode.
For regular episodes, just so that they have a bit more content. We're not going to get into the deals.
Yeah, right. Not the boring stuff. But yeah, just like one regular episode a month. And then the other episode will be our bonus episode, by the way, segment where we just talk about current issues or, you know, kind of just anything we want to talk about that day. So it'll be an every 2 weeks, back to our original schedule, basically. So instead of three times a month, we're going to take it back down to two.
Hey, who did you say you were?
Travis Barker.
Oh, go stream Transparent Soul.
By so good.
Willow and Travis Barker. It's so amazing. There is nothing that Willow Smith's vocal cords cannot do.
It's very like alt rock perfection. So good. Perfect. Well,
this month we watched The Handmaiden and it was fire, some gas. It was extremely erotic. If you haven't watched The Handmaiden, it's basically just a lesbian love story and drama. And it was almost like a mystery the way it broke down.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was by a Korean director named Park Chan-wook. The whole thing was in Korean. It took place both in Korea and Japan, and it centers around the two main characters, like love interest, right? Hideko and Suki. And Suki was supposed to be the handmaiden for the super rich, like, heir or something like that. Japanese heir. And the whole plan on her side was to swindle her out of her money and like put her in a madhouse so that she gets all of her inheritance or whatever. But then she ends up falling for her. It's really, that's so cute. That's a cute love story.
Yeah.
The crook turns good or something.
The movie's definitely been compared to, I think it sort of falls into that period drama love story that like Portrait of a Lady on Fire falls into and Call Me by Your Name and stuff like that. I feel like The Handmaiden is sort of in that genre. Like Delbar said, it's a romance story, it's a drama, it's a thriller.
It's a love story, revenge thriller.
Yeah.
And puzzle film is what people call it.
Yeah.
And it takes place, again, in Japanese-occupied Korea in the 1930s. And the director, Park Chan-wook, actually started out only as a critic. And he also directed Old Boy, which is
so another fantastic movie.
That's like from the early 2000s, and yeah, it's so good. He also did Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. I haven't seen Lady Vengeance and Thirst.
I haven't seen those, but same.
Exciting
stuff. I've been wanting to watch this movie for a long time, and it definitely lived up to the hype. If anything, I don't think it gets enough hype.
Yeah. It was so intricate, but also like light-footed.
Yeah. It's one of those movies where you could tell that every little thing was intentional. Like, there was no shot or angle or line that wasn't intentional, wasn't some kind of clue, or wasn't just purely, like, thematic and beautiful. Like, every piece of the movie was, like, polished. And I love shit like that. Like, don't get me wrong, I love the regular, like, trashy romantic movie. But, like, films like this, it's just, like, such a pleasure to watch and, like, try to figure everything out.
It was really nice.
So, there's essentially four main characters. Obviously, Suki and Hideko are, like, the main characters. They are the love interest. But there's also these two secondary characters that play into the plot. So, Suki is the one that we mentioned gets hired to be the handmaiden. But she's actually, you know, this really clever, witty pickpocket, and she gets hired by this man that gets called the Count to
basically, like, a family friend.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to distinguish exactly what their relationship is, but we assume he's like a family friend. And he hires Suki to trick this rich heiress into going to a mental institution and inheriting her fortune. And the Count is just like this really sleazy, like cocky and demanding man. He is a Korean posing as a Japanese like art forger. And this is all part of the scheme that he has going with Suki. And this is where we meet Hideko.
Hideko is, I think, she's also an orphaned heiress. She's a Japanese heiress of some kind. And she has, like, a very large estate. And she doesn't have siblings, as far as I know. Both of her parents are dead. I think her mother died giving birth to her, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
And she's very lonely and, like, very numbed out from all the fucking shit that her uncle makes her do. Her uncle, like, what is, like, her overseer?
Yeah, pretty much.
Guardian at this point? How old do you think she is? She's over 18.
I think she's over 18, but I think it's not she has to come of age. It's she has to get married for the fortune to be released.
Oh.
So it doesn't matter how old she is if she's not married.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fucked. She lives in a very gloomy place. She describes it herself as, like, very gloomy and gray and, like, anyway. But, yeah, she's like, sad as fuck.
Yeah.
She's a sad character.
Yeah. And she's originally portrayed as, like, really naive and, like, aloof. And then as the plot unravels, you begin to see that she's, like, not as innocent as she would have you believe and things mm-hmm. like that.
We start seeing, like, her actual personality later on. It's so nice.
Every one of the characters is, like, the character building is really well done, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
But we can get into that more when we get down to, like, the technical stuff, I guess.
Her uncle, like, her relationship to her mm-hmm. uncle. Her uncle, she's almost, like, underhand, like, fearful and domesticated,
mm-hmm.
like, subservient. She's almost, like, his employee because she's reading. So she's reading, like, these basically erotic smut.
Yeah, it's pretty much smut. It's, like, ancient, not ancient, but, it, like, these really old-fashioned, like, vintage porno mags.
Mm-hmm. Out loud to a group of men.
The movie is very literally about the male gaze. Again, we'll get into that more, but she's literally in a position where she's being objectified by a room full of men that are simply looking at her. Like, oof.
It's gross. It's so gross.
You disgusting. Can see they're like
greasy men. They're all just sitting there in silence and she's just like reading and making these sounds and shit. It's like, what the fuck, bro?
She was basically her aunt's replacement in this.
Yeah. And he was always abusive even to her and perverted.
Yes, very. But her aunt had to do the same thing at one point and her aunt ended up dying by suicide. Supposedly, they kind of insinuate that the uncle might have had something to do with it, but we don't know for sure.
Well, remember when he took her to the basement?
Right. Oh, my God, the basement. Oh my God.
She was a child. Fuck that dude.
Yeah, fuck the uncle. I wish his death was more brutal. But anyway.
That part.
She literally lost, like, her only mother figure to suicide because of her having to read these erotic magazines to a bunch of dirty old men to the point where she killed herself because of it. And then she has to replace this woman that she lost. And now she's stuck with her abusive uncle by herself. Like, I can't imagine the, like, mental prison this woman was in.
She's like numbed out. Like, we don't even, she barely has her personality until, like, the middle and end. Right. Like,
yeah,
I think Suki has a lot more personality coming in, but Hideko, like, she's very dry humor, like, again, like, really subservient, but later on we find out how clever she is.
I would say that, like, Suki is, like, more lively, but
she's witty,
but Hideko is, like, captivating. Like, you're very, like, invested in Hideko's character because, like, I read this article. It was almost written like a research paper it was called Escaping the Male Gaze by Leo Ortega. He brought up, without getting into too much detail for now, he basically said that Hideko was somehow, like, innocent and not innocent at the same time. Like, if her innocence has been, like, taken from her because of what she has to do for her uncle. And when we get the first sex scene, it's, like, very male gazey. It's very, like, provocative. And, like, it seems like she, you know, knows what she's doing. Like, Suki calls her a natural.
Yes.
But then we see her innocent side come out when we get to the scene where Suki starts tearing apart the library. Yeah. And you see that Hideko didn't even really grasp, like, as miserable as she was, you could tell that Hideko thought that what was happening to her was, like, normal. Like, she knew it was bad, but, like, what was she going to do about it, basically? So she's innocent and not innocent at the same time. And that's why she's, like, so, like, such a complex character.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. She's both.
Yeah.
She was smart enough to trick Suki back.
Or right.
At least pretend to, well, you know. Yeah, she's... Yeah.
Turns out she was the mastermind behind the whole thing, essentially.
What did you think of how their relationship represented queer culture? Culture tropes, queer culture tropes, too.
I really loved that it was, like, a really, like, it was, like, this really, like, refreshing take on the, like, killing the husband and running away together type of thing. Because not only was it, like, finally, like, a quality, you know, queer movie with women of color. And so that was, like, important right off the bat. But just, like, their relationship being, like, really tender and, like, them being friends and, like, running away together and everything like that. And, like, being each other's, like, freedom, basically. Oh, it was amazing. How about you?
I think a queer culture trope that I found was, like, the whole... Yeah, of course they, like, killed the fucking uncle off together. I love that. Her captor?
Yeah. Both of them.
Prison warden? Yeah, a queer culture trope that I found was how, like, shyly intimate they were at first. That's always a thing where, like, if there's a budding romance in a woman loving woman movie... They're all, the first one is always so shy to make the fucking move. It's always so hesitant, even when they do make the first couple moves.
Yeah.
It's all very shy and, like, almost fearful. Like, there's, like, this sense of risk behind it, or, like, like, doing something, like, sneakily.
Like, it feels very serious, like, right off the bat, like, very intense. So, like, you don't want to, like, go too hard or a little break type of thing. Like, there's, like, this mutual, like, pining thing for a while. Yeah.
It's yeah. Really cool. It's always so gingerly done at first. Yeah. And it's, like, that's definitely a trope I saw right away. They're both so scared to make the first move.
It was so cool, too. I actually kind of just thought of this. It was really cool to see, like, a... there was, like... a sort of coming out story without, like, actually coming out, right? Like, it was these two women discovering, you know, coming to, you know, fruition with their sexuality or whatever. And you could get the implications of, like, the culture they're in, you know, Korea in the 1930s, where, like, a woman has to be subservient to a man, you know, a man, you can't control your own money as a woman, like, type of economic marriage thing going on. So you get the cultural implications without it being racist and, like, without it being the center of the plot. And you get, like, a really sweet, like, no tension, no, like, shame type of coming.
It turns out into that.
I yeah.
think, from beginning to end.
Yeah. Like, they were never really, it didn't seem like the hesitation was because they were both women. Like, they had sex pretty fast.
But they were, like, hesitant to, like, be gay together, you know? Or even to each other.
Right? I didn't get that vibe.
Sure.
I don't know. I guess it's up to, like, interpretation, but still, I thought it was, like, a really cool
story. Yeah, I wonder really cool what other story. People think. Yeah, and the other trope that I found was, like, yeah, they're killing the husband figure together.
The Count?
Oh, you know, not the Count, sorry. Yeah, Hideko's uncle.
Yeah, some, like, Hideko is, like, literally trapped with either of these two men that want, her uncle wants to marry her first of all.
Yeah, he is, like, a husband figure to her because, like,
yeah,
woman and man in the house, that's all I'm talking
about. Yeah.
Like, at that time, 1930s? Yeah. They killed him together. They killed the husband figure together. Love that. Queer culture trope shit. Love that shit.
The funniest part is, though, is that they didn't actually kill anyone. They just fed into the men, and the men were each other's demise.
Right. Love that.
Oh, they didn't even have to do anything. They just had to take themselves out of the equation.
I love
That's insane.
Love it. Because it was on fire anyway.
Yes.
You just had to pit them in the right direction.
So that kind of, I read another article by Gia Tolentino called like Finding Freedom with Other Women. Sorry. And it was basically compared like the feeling of this movie to like sleight of hand, like a sleight of hand magic trick.
Like they did in Knives Out.
But Park, the director, basically changed something from the source material, which we'll get into later. He changed something in the source material to actually have the women end up together and get their freedom and get their power. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, you mean like after they adapted it from Fingersmith?
Yeah, because apparently in Fingersmith that doesn't like happen. Or at least not at that point. Like in Fingersmith, at the point where Suki and Hideko like ran away together, in Fingersmith, supposedly there was like another twist that like continued the story or whatever. Okay. But anyway, Park made the decision to, you know, give these women their autonomy. They found their freedom in each other and like another woman, and how there is like no, it reminded me of that feeling where like, you know, the whole atmosphere of a room changes when a cis man is there.
Yes.
You know, and it's like they finally found like themselves because they had another woman and they were only surrounded by women.
There's this unspoken understanding.
Yeah.
At least to some degree when it's just women in the room. Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, like the sex is only liberating when it's between them. Mm-hmm. Like the men aren't involved. And it's just like, it comes back to this idea that being a lesbian or being, you know, anything but hetero is sort of like a revolutionary act. It's like the ultimate like anti-patriarchal thing to not be into men. You're literally subverting the main aspect of what it means to be a woman by not being into men.
Don't I fucking know it. The way dudes look at
you. Oh my God.
When you tell them, like, especially a dude who finds you attractive. Yeah. And you tell them that you're gay.
It's like they're,
talking to you earlier. Like, yeah. The way that they stiffen up, like, they don't know what to say. It's almost like they don't even see you as a woman anymore.
No.
It's,
if you're not, like, fuckable, they don't know how you're to talk not a to person. Exactly. And it's,
I can't believe it.
It's because so much of men's power has been reinforced by women needing them for economic reasons. So men just expect women to be into men, and women have always had to be with a man to uphold the patriarchy. But now, at least in our culture, not being into men is like part of breaking down the patriarchy. You're taking that power away because that's all they have is like their power over you.
Everything that masculinity is based around in a physical way or even in a power way, it ties back to the patriarchal concept that women need men for sexual satisfaction. Like they need them, and otherwise, without it, oh no.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like without it, they can't have kids, and then what the fuck are they good for?
Yeah,
I mean?
Exactly.
So it's like, I don't know, whatever. It's just,
I just think it's like funny almost that them finding love and like pleasure in each other as women, like, was literally the demise of the men.
Right, that in and of itself.
Yeah, it's like everything that they everything that is like figurative and subliminal in the movie has like a literal scene with it, you know?
Symbolism.
Yeah.
Symbolism.
Heavy, heavy.
Yeah. I noticed that there was a symbol for like repeating words and phrases.
Really?
Yeah.
A symbol. Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
Sorry, a motif.
I know. Yeah, I know what you mean now. Sorry.
Oh my God. I don't have, like, specific things, but, like, do you remember when, like, one of them would say something and it would get repeated elsewhere, either in somebody else's, like, dialogue completely, in a completely different conversation, or, like, they would repeat something?
There was something that, like, the Count originally said to Hideko that Hideko ended up repeating to Suki.
Yeah, I don't have a good memory. But isn't that so interesting? Sometimes it happened intentionally and sometimes it didn't at all.
Yeah. It felt like it was part of them, like, getting their freedom or whatever. Like, them reclaiming, like, words that men had said to them. Or, like,
I think it was just the touch from the director. I think it was just like maybe a signature thing. Because it happened both outside of the queer relationship.
Yeah.
And like one person said something in the beginning and then someone else at the end, like random ass.
God, I wish I could remember what they said. Same.
The other like symbol I saw was the snake, obviously. We both commented on it while watching the movie. Mm-hmm. We watched the movie twice. Wow. Educated bitches. The snake was, and then like Suki beheading the snake, like go off. Like a whole ass hero ass, Prince Charming ass.
It was like this barrier. It was like this, it was like a freaking, what are they called? Gargoyle. It was like guarding the church. Mm-hmm. It was like the snake guarding the library. Like you don't come past this point. And then like, it was like a jail cell and like, Suki broke free, kind of.
It was literally like slaying the dragon.
Right. Yes. You exactly. Rescued a princess from her exactly.
tower. I mean, a snake is a little.
Yes. Big. That, oh, you have no idea how satisfying that just was.
I know. No, because she like did the actual movement with like Hideko behind her.
Yes. She beheaded the snake with a sword.
Like how you see in the cartoons. Fuck. Literally.
Oh my God. That's so satisfying. Wow. Isn't that Thank cool? you.
Park Chan-wook is very good with symbolism.
Yes.
We don't have to talk about this now, but if you've ever seen Old Boy is also a revenge thriller, but the guy in it loses his mind. And the twist at the end, not a single thing was left unspoken for.
And it's heartbreaking.
He's so good at thriller and like throwing you off. Because
it really is like sleight of hand. That's exactly what it feels
like. Sleight of hand is such a good phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's conning us. He's swindling us.
He gets you every time. Like,
it was such a good movie. It reminded me of Knives Out.
Yeah. The pacing was so good because it like revealed the twist at like the exact time. Like right before you would start like smelling something, he'd like switch up on you.
Yeah.
The film itself is broken down into like three distinct chapters, I would say. The first chapter is like them being introduced and like, the first chapter to me kind of reminded me of Parasite because it was like these lower class people wanting to con higher class people and then playing a role and like sneaking behind their back and things just unraveling from the deception.
Rehearsing what you're gonna say to con the said like, right. rich family, yeah, everything.
And then the second part reminded me of The Perfection, and I have to believe that The Perfection was inspired by The Handmaiden because they're similarly like laid out. Like the first third is one woman deceiving the other. The second third is finding out that the second woman was also deceiving the other first.
Maybe that's like a queer culture trope.
I think it might be because in the third act, in both of the movies, we find out that they were working together the entire time.
Yes. And we had no idea.
Yeah. So that second part sort of reveal. And the third part too, obviously, because that's when like the actual, you know, revelation and them running the way together comes to play. So those two movies, I think, were like really, and like you said, Knives Out as far as like the actual like pacing goes.
Yeah. I only said Knives Out because like the way that they run through everything that happened
from multiple like perspectives.
In the beginning, it was the inverse perspective at the end. And I was like, oh, word, like Knives Out did that when they walked us through. And then walked us through again.
The vibe is very similar.
Thriller. Yeah. I love it. So satisfying.
Yeah.
Maybe we just like mysteries. Not mystery, I guess. Really. What do you call it? Thriller, right?
I think it's thriller, yeah. It's not quite suspense.
Where we're thrown off.
Yeah. You know? I like it. It almost feels like a heist movie or like a spy movie at some points. You know, like
heist movie.
Like when Suki's in jail, not in jail, sorry, when Suki gets admitted to the mental hospital.
Yeah.
Even though like it was part of the plan, we have like her three friends that were back from Japan that like helped her. I mean, sorry, back from Korea, like her hometown in Korea to help her break out of the mental institution with like their costumes. There's like these little moments of comic relief almost also throughout the movie, which I think, oh, they were so good.
It had a lot of different tones. Like, yeah, funny, horror, and drama thriller, you know?
I remember the first time we watched it, we had both noted, like, probably 20 minutes in that, like, we couldn't pin down the tone for it. We were like, the tone is all over the place.
Even the genre.
Yeah.
Some people said it's like a gothic thriller, like Jane Eyre.
Yeah. It does kind of feel like that, like, period piece drama.
Yeah.
On top of everything.
I thought it almost had, like, a Shakespearean Victorian vibe.
Yeah, too. For sure.
Gothic. I love that shit.
Another thing that I think we both noticed was when Hideko wears gloves and when she doesn't. So we see that, like, she has, like, this really, I'm trying to think, not elaborate. It's not an elaborate collection. It's a...
Elaborate.
Okay. I guess it is. Okay. We find out that Hideko has, like, this elaborate collection of gloves, and she always wears gloves when she's, like, around certain people, and, like, she takes them off, like, very, like, matter-of-factly. And there's, like, again, like I said earlier, there's, like, a metaphor, and then there's always, like, a solid scene to back it up to make it literal, where we have, they're on the boat, and they're, like, escaping at the end of part two or whatever, and Hideko literally takes off her glove and, like, holds hands with Suki.
It was, like, it had that much more meaning.
Yeah. She, like, uses it to, it reminded me of Theo from Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah, me too.
Where she only took off her glove when she was, like, feeling vulnerable, or like she was okay with feeling vulnerable, at least.
And, like, it's she literally was, her letting herself be vulnerable. Yeah. Like, literally.
It's like a veil.
You're unveiling your hand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's so pretty, the way that, that's so intentional.
Yeah.
It just kind of, like, if she takes off her glove just for Suki to hold it, it implies so much. Like, it implies that, like, she's normally a closed off person because she has to be, like, numbs out her emotions because she has to be. And the only person who has ever really gotten to see her or, like, feel her, I guess, technically, is Suki.
Yeah.
That's so nice.
I also feel like sex itself in the movie was a symbol.
Like, a double standard.
Yeah, it was, like, this marker of, like, where you are in the story and, like, what we know about the characters. And so, like, the first part of the movie is when we're getting Suki's, you know, perspective. And the first sex scene is short, and it's very male-gazy. It's very, like, gratuitously pornographic, like, unrealistic lesbian sex type stuff. Because nobody
scissors. Thank you. I'll say it. Who scissors? Anyway. Yeah, you were saying.
And at this point in the story, we believe Hideko is just, like, this, like, she's this perfect example of, like, the submissive, like, Asian woman who's, you know, like, what is it? Hideko in the first half of the movie is sort of portrayed as this, like, you know, stereotypical, like, Western Asian stereotype of, like, the woman being the, you know, lady in the street, but a freak in the sheets, like, thing. And we think she's just, like, this naive person. So we get this really, like, male-gazy sex scene under the, you know, point at that time where they were both, like, tied to these men. Like, at this point in the story, they're very, you know, confined within the patriarchy. So the sex scene sort of matches that, where it's, like, this very gratuitous, fake sex scene.
Yeah.
And then in the second half, when it gets revealed that actually Hideko had more autonomy over the situation,
it's more realistic.
Yeah, we get to see, like, a more in-depth, like, development of the relationship, where it turns from lust to love. And then we get the longer sex scene that's just a continuation of the first. And they're no longer doing this role-playing thing where Hideko wants to know what sex is going to be like with the Count for the first time.
It's, like, as themselves.
Yeah, like, they're actually talking as themselves, and they're, like, promising never to betray each other and stuff like that. So as soon as we get them, you know, more together, get like starting to gain the freedom together, we get a more like natural sex scene, which is also shot differently. Like there's no longer these really like pornographic close-ups. Like it's shot at like this bird's eye view, and it's just like you see them like together.
That's so true.
And then by the end, and it also plays into like the power dynamics at the time where Hideko is like a Japanese woman. Who's like rich, and Suki is like a poor Korean woman. And at the time of the story, it's like the 1930s. So this is like under Korea was under Japanese occupation. So like that's important. And like both of the sex scenes, they're sort of like, you can sort of see their power dynamic like in the shot. Like there's like often time where Hideko is like above Suki, but like in the final sex scene, it's like perfect symmetry. They've escaped the men. They're completely like by themselves and like just, you know, themselves, and like they're in the middle, like equal. It's like a perfectly symmetrical shot, and like they're finally equals once they've escaped the patriarchy. Ugh, it's so intricate.
Wow. God damn. Amazing writing. Yeah, no, some of the shots were super symmetrical. Even like split down, you know how like sometimes it creates like awkwardness when the camera is pulled away from the two subjects or from the subjects like aren't center, and there's like negative space next to them, and you just kind of are expecting something to show up.
Yeah,
they did that where there were three subjects in an exact like perfect line. Like it was so sometimes it looked very like you said Wes Anderson.
Yes.
I also thought Wes Anderson, because Wes Anderson likes to do that thing where like almost every camera shot looks like it could be a painting or looks like it could be its own standalone photograph.
There's always like an extended scene of like a close up on someone's hands when they're just like doing something mundane.
Oh my God.
I love how Wes Anderson is shot. Like that sounds so pretentious, I know, but I love it.
No, no. It doesn't sound pretentious. I love his work.
It's just so artistic, and this was like that too. It was it was the whole thing. Like it's not just a movie, like it's a work of art. Okay. Like it's such
Get out of my house.
A good
No, I know.
It well done
so
movie.
So good. It's a fuck. I mean, we haven't rated yet, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And also, like, the dark blue tones. We're talking about cinematography. Yes. Yeah, okay. The dark blue tones and the, like, minimal lighting. Because Hideko said herself, like, oh, like, no light is here. It's, like, a gloomy place, whatever the fuck. And because, like, so the lighting was so minimal, it reminded me of David Fincher's directing style. He did Gone Girl. And you remember, like, how in Gone Girl, there was, like, a dark, like, a navy tinge over everything.
Yeah. Like, kind of,
The home, the car, fucking, like, everything. Yeah. And then, like, a dull, dark blue tone. Like, almost gray.
Yeah.
This had that.
The Social Network was like that, too.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Also yes. David Fincher.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Do you like anything particular about the acting? How they made the people act.
Like the directing, basically.
Yeah.
I loved the actress that played Hideko. Like the one scene where this is like post-sex and like they are like sort of realizing that they have feelings for each other, and Hideko asks Suki if she should still marry the Count, and like Suki's still, you know, playing into it, and she's like, yes, you have to like marry him, whatever, because she still wants to get her money or whatever. That scene where Hideko like takes Suki and is like pushing her out of the room, she has like crazy eyes, and it reminded me of how they did the eyes in Black Swan, like when she went like at the end where her eyes were like really red and like inflamed and just wide.
It was like that.
Like reminded me of that, because she was crying but she was furious. Right. And like
same with the subject chamber.
They made Hideko like really intense, and they made Suki really lighthearted and like gentle. Yeah.
Hideko wasn't as gentle.
No.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's a lot hard. Like, her heart was supposed to be, like, a lot harder
at
the beginning of the movie.
And right.
Yeah. The character development was so amazing, like the progression of that, yes. Who they are at the beginning, who they are to like at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god. And don't even get me started on the costume design.
Oh.
The set design.
Bro.
The fucking drip, like dark ass blue and green gothic design.
That one scene where they're in like the study and they were supposed to paint. But, like, we have, like Hideko gets up from the easel and, like, sits on the couch. And Suki is just standing by the, like, on the other side of the easel with, like, her hands crossed in front of her, just, like, looking at Hideko. But Hideko's, like, looking out into the empty space that's, like, taking up the other third. And they just pause there for a second. And it's, like, this... It's like one of those shots where only the first two thirds are taken up and like the third is completely empty and they just pause and it looks like a painting.
I read in an article that was intentional because it looked like a painting.
Yeah. Oh, it, oh.
Like the director was like, no, leave it here. Yeah. Because he actually wanted us to like take that moment and like soak it in.
Yeah.
He put the time aside for that. I love that.
So much.
It reminds you instantly that like, I'm watching a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
That. I love. Oh my God. We're just like gushing over how much I like this movie. This movie should have won Best Picture.
Yeah. What the fuck?
Snub? The was hell? It even nominated? I think the sex scenes put people off.
Probably.
The Academy off.
Yeah.
Fucking old white men. I'm sure. Something that was weird for me for the acting was like how there was so much emotion or lack of emotion. How there was the presence of, like, emotion or lack thereof. Like, lack of emotion was really big in this. Like, I think Hideko showed us, gave us a lot of, like, lack of emotion.
Yeah. She was always in some sort of, like, stunned silence or something. Yeah.
And as an actor, right? Because I'm sure if you're actually like that, it's easy. But you're acting that way. I feel like that's hard to do.
Yeah.
I feel like it's hard to just... You're an actor. All you're supposed to do, your whole job is to like wear the emotions, like exaggerate the emotions of the characters. And she is doing the opposite. Like she's very muted. Yeah. She's very muted. That's because
she has to be secretive. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I just thought Hideko was a really good actor specifically for that.
To go back to how it's like escaping the male gaze, another like, really like on the nose scene with that was we get like half a sex scene between Hideko and the Count and we get a whole like shot just held on Hideko with this guy like trying to seduce her and like touching her and shit and we just see on her face that she's so uninterested in sex with a man and it ruins the fantasy because that any man could possibly like get from this film because we see that she is so truly not interested in sex with a man. She's completely faking it. She's only doing it to get poison him. Spoiler alert.
That's so true because in mainstream porn, lesbians, quote unquote, the lesbian sex video, like they're always also attracted to the man.
Right.
That's just a thing. Yeah. In mainstream, like nasty conventional porn.
Yeah.
That's like horrible.
Yeah.
That even a lesbian can't always fully be a lesbian. Like, no. You're still a woman and you're still hot to me. So you're definitely not allowed to not find me attractive.
Right.
Even though you claim to be a lesbian. You're right. It does, like, fuck everything up for the men watching.
I like that. I like that it's so, like, surprising that it's so surprising to me that a male director could pull this off.
Right?
But he's self-identified as a feminist, so I guess I'll believe him.
Did you know he also worked on Snowpiercer?
Yeah, I read that. Oh, imagine being that talented.
I feel like that these last several movies, like how you said this reminded you a little bit of Parasite, too. I have a feeling things like Train to Busan, like how these like recent Korean films and shows are getting very, very, very popular in the US.
And getting US remakes for some fucking reason.
But you know, like Death Note, the anime? It was redone in America with, like, all white characters.
With Alex Wolff, yes.
Nat Wolff. I didn't know it was with Nat Wolff.
Nat Wolff, yeah.
Yee.
Man, fuck Naked Brothers. What the fuck? Anyways. Alex Wolff is really good in Hereditary, though. I'll give him that.
I loved Hereditary.
Weird that the Naked Brothers Band are, like, good actors. Who'd have thunk it?
They're talented. Nat Wolff was a good fucking actor in a horror movie. Oh, yeah. I feel like Americans are starting to really like Korean cinema.
Yeah.
I mean, with Parasite winning Best Picture, that's a big fucking deal. The whole thing is in...
I think Minari won an Oscar, too.
So, yeah, Minari, too.
Yeah.
I think it's, like, America's lean into Korean cinema, like, as a whole. I feel like all Korean cinema is probably, like...
Another thing that I noticed was, again, like, playing into men, like, needing to know that women are attracted to them or whatever. Men are, like, literally blind to things right in front of their face because they cannot fathom you not being attracted to them. Like, men cannot fathom you not being, you know... the first thing on their mind, because like Suki and Hideko were affectionate in front of the count, and it just never occurred to him that they were a thing. Like, they were holding hands on the boat and like leaning on each other.
That's true. I don't think he even fucking knew.
It never occurred to him that they could possibly be a thing. Like, it never, I don't even think by the end of the movie, either of the men actually knew what happened. I don't think they actually put it together that they ran away together and that they were lovers. They were so wrapped up in themselves.
Fucking bullshit. Yeah. That's so true.
It just never occurred to either of them. And again, they were each other's demise.
Hey, if you've been looking for ways to help out and educate yourself, please visit bicons.com/resources.
Here you'll find Black Lives Matter, First Nations support, and LGBTQI+ outreach.
Do your part.
There's always a way to help.
So, yeah, there's a 2002 novel called Fingersmith by a Welsh writer named Sarah Waters, and it's this story, but it took place in Victorian British era. So it goes from, you know, Victorian British to 1930s Korea under Japanese colonial rule, right? I really like that they took this story. Not that, like, white queer stories aren't important. They are. I just think it's cool that to make an adaptation of that novel, they just recast as women of color.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's so, I like that. Yeah. I like that because it's the same story. It's just as applicable. It's just literally diversification of a single story.
And that's really cool. And if anything, this is the more popular version. Like, I'd never heard of The Fingersmith until I watched The Handmaiden and found out that The Fingersmith was the source material. Like, there was a whole show called The Fingersmith and I never heard of it.
Now I want to read this novel.
Right.
But yeah, the movie itself, but The Handmaiden was selected to compete for the Palme d'Or in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Cannes Film Festival. But I don't think the TV show of The Fingersmith got any major recognition.
No, right? I don't think so either. Yeah, this one, like, won awards and shit. And it's, like, a pinnacle, you know, queer movie now.
Imagine
all the movies you're missing out on because you don't like subtitles. Like, imagine being that close-minded. I can't. Apparently, Sarah Waters, you know, writes a lot of lesbian love stories. There's
really?
And like they're all the names are kind of like plays on like sex acts, but like they don't sound like it kind of thing, like The Fingersmith. And she has another book called Tipping the Velvet and another book called
Ew.
The Paying Guests. Yeah, very.
Are they, maybe it's like erotica.
I think it's like on the scale of like what The Fingersmith is and what The Handmaiden is. But apparently there's like a theme in all of her books of like this idea of concealment and reinvention, where like the women are sort of running this scheme, or like they're hiding something from themselves, and they find, you know, that freedom and like love in each other, and that's how they like, you know, reinvent themselves or whatever. And apparently that's like a thing that she addresses a lot.
I loved the narration that one character would give the other. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like an inner monologue that they had about, and it was like always loving and like endearing. And one time Hideko was describing Suki, and she said, the daughter of a legendary thief, sewed winter coats out of stolen purses, herself a thief, pickpocket, swindler, the savior who came to tear my life apart. My Tamako, my Suki. The fucking cutest way.
I know, and like the first time Suki sees Hideko, her inner monologue says, oh, he didn't tell me she was so pretty.
Another quote I really liked was when the count was like talking about money and like how bad he wanted to get rich.
Mm-hmm.
Remember?
Yeah.
And he said specifically, what I desire is, how shall I put it, the manner of ordering wine without looking at the price. That felt like Parasite. Yeah. Like they wanted to be that level of rich. Like,
yeah.
Beyond comfortable.
Yeah.
Like that is so specific.
That's always how, not like, that sentiment is always how, like, I've described how I wanted to be for a long time. Like, I just want to be in a position where I don't have to look at the price tag. Like, imagine, like, to me, that's, like, the height of luxury.
But, yeah.
And yeah. It's, and that's how you know that, like, he comes from a poor background, or, like, he's ashamed of, like, a poor background, because to rich people who are born rich and who are always rich,
that's have a visceral experience seeing a rich person do that.
Yeah, like, they were born and raised always having enough money and, like, never having to look at the price tag. So, like, that's nothing to them. Whereas, like, for poor people, that's, like, the richest thing you can imagine.
It's the first thing you look at.
Yeah. What do you think the deal was with the octopus? I think I'm still slightly confused by that, because the octopus is not only, like, being held in that, like, really tiny tank in the basement or whatever. Like, he's, like, the octopus is, like, the freaking uncle's captive, practically. But the octopus is also, like, in the pictures in the books that Hideka has to read from. So I guess I just don't, like, actually know what the octopus is supposed to be.
I never saw the octopus as his, prisoner. I always saw the octopus as his weapon.
Oh, okay. Yeah, true.
Because he used it to, like, traumatize Hideko, but also he used it to kill her mother.
I think, wasn't it?
Sorry, her aunt. What the fuck? Yeah. I honestly haven't thought about it. But I never did see it as a prisoner, I'll say that.
Crazy how, like, I swear to God, patriarchy and white supremacy is literally, like, what came first, the chicken or the egg.
So true.
You can't break it down. Like, one cannot exist without the other. And, like, to take one of them down is to take both of them down. My favorite scene, hands down, is when Hideko finally reveals to Suki, like, the library and shows her the books and, like, the scrolls and stuff that she has to read from.
1000% yes.
This is, like, that moment where Hideko she's made innocent again. Like, Suki breaks, like, literally tears this fucking library, showroom, whatever you want to call it, apart, because she finds out what the uncle has been doing to Hideko all these years. And, like,
avenging her.
Yeah. By, like, Suki destroying all of this, Hideko kind of gets some of her innocence back. And you see that because, like, while Suki is tearing the library apart, Hideko, like, cannot bring herself for the longest time to, like, help. Like,
she's still terrified.
The first time she actually, like, starts participating, Suki is destroyed the shelves at this point, has, like, ripped up the floor. She's starting to throw books into the water. And the only thing Hideko can think to do is get ink and throw it on the books. And that takes, like, a lot out of her. And you can see when she does it, she has, like, this moment of, like, freedom, but also fear, like, at the same time. And, like,
it was almost awkward because, like, you could tell it was the very first time she's ever defied any of that shit.
This is something she could have never imagined she could do. Oh my God. I love that so much. It was, like, good for her. Like, this is exactly
good for her. That's also, like, a queer movie trope.
Yeah.
But good for her.
Yeah.
It was even more heartwarming that Suki, like, took it upon herself to go, like, that hard for her, you know?
Yeah. She was horrified. Right. Yeah. She was absolutely horrified. She didn't care that the uncle would, like, find out. Like, she wasn't scared of him. She was just, like, purely disgusted by him and destroyed everything. She didn't care if she was going to get in trouble. She did not give a fuck. She was
kill him too.
Determined to get out of there, no matter what. Like, to get Hideko out of there, I mean. And that reminds me, when we were, I'll put the video in the, like, sources that we cite on our website. But I remember in the video we watched that kind of, like, broke down The Handmaiden, the guy had mentioned that in this similar vein to, like, Hideko never realizing she could have, like, destroyed this library, they have, like, another, like, literal example where Hideko can't get over the wall
Yes, and needed Suki's help.
Yeah, and it turned out just to be like a short wall after all this time. Like it was something. Yeah, it was something that like could have been so easy, but like because of her worldview, she never could have imagined this happening until now.
That was really nice. It was only like fucking 2 feet high.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah.
From the freedom.
And the scene right after that where they're literally running through the fields and like smiling and laughing. Oh, gorgeous. God. Gorgeous. It gives me the ending that I wish Portrait of a Lady on Fire had. Like, it's...
I think this was better than that movie.
Yeah, it's so much more satisfying to me rather than seeing, like... Don't get me wrong, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is, like, beautiful and everything, and I love it, but... It's so sad, like, not seeing them be together after all of that.
Yeah, it, like, kills you and stuff.
Yeah, it fucking sucks. As beautiful as it is, it fucking sucks. And, like, it's cool that in The Handmaiden, this director chose to, like, give them their freedom and put them together. And I love it.
Yeah. A lot of women loving women, or gay movies, make the homosexual attraction, like, the fatal flaw.
Yeah.
Of the...
You're never going to be happy this way. Society's never going to accept you.
Their attraction to the other love interest is what makes it their demise or whatever.
Right.
What makes their demise, whatever. But in this one, it's what rescued Hideko.
Yeah.
You know. All too often, it's like, what was that one movie we watched with Rachel Weisz?
Disobedience.
Ugh. That was like tragic as fuck.
Yes.
How like, you know, whatever. Didn't go to New York with her.
Why? Literally, why?
They easily could have done it, and like they had so many chances to do it, like so many almost chances.
Yeah,
it was fucking heart wrenching.
Yeah,
Portrait of a Lady on Fire. That shit was heart wrenching. Blue is the warmest color.
Like, I refuse to watch that movie.
Don't watch that movie. That's it.
I feel like Blue is the Warmest Color is like the complete antithesis of this movie.
It really is, in terms of like. Everything.
Yeah, like the power structure is different and better.
Everything's better. The writing's
they're
better.
Both male directors, and yet this one didn't completely like objectify its actresses. We're about to give our ratings, but first I wanted to talk about how the ratings were, you know, in the world. We talked about it a little bit with like how they won awards and stuff like that. But I feel like a lot of like amateur critics really, the point kind of goes over their head. So like I saw a lot of criticism.
Not that we aren't amateur critics.
Right. Of course not. But I feel like a lot of people, all the criticism that this movie did get was about the gratuitous sex scene and like about it being just like a lesbian porn and how male gazy it was. And to me, that just tells me that the point went over your head when the movie is explicitly about escaping the male gaze and it executes that. I feel like it gets a bad rep for being pornographic and male gazy, but it's, if you actually watch it and pay attention, it's a complete subversion of the male gaze. It's an abolition of the male. Like it's.
Maybe if someone isn't understanding that or seeing that, they should watch Blue is the Warmest Color.
Yeah.
As comparison,
yeah. Anyway, how many octopi out of 10 would you give the movie overall?
12. This is just so easy.
Yeah.
12 out of 10.
Oh my God.
15 out of 10.
It's it's one of the most satisfying movies I've ever watched. Gorgeous.
This should be the movie that is like the lesbian movie.
Yeah.
When someone says lesbian movie, it should be this. Not Blue is
the
Warmest.
This is like the epitome of that Lady Gaga gif where she's going like amazing, incredible, blah, 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 magnificent. Like that's this movie. That is this movie. So clearly we loved it.
Go watch it. Go watch Fingersmith if you can. Yeah. I think it must be good. Or read it.
It had a lot of seasons.
Don't watch Blue is the Warmest Color. That's the takeaway.
The consensus hit. So next episode will be one of our By the Way segments, volumes, as you will, where we'll just discuss something pop culture-y or like, you know, queer culture topics and stuff like that. And then we'll be back with a regular episode.
And the episode after that, which is like our content-based episode, that will be about I'm Not Okay With This. Adios, muchachos.
I think that's it. See you in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to the Vicons podcast. Music by DaVinci_Beats. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, subscribe, and share. It helps us a lot.
To keep up with new episodes, you can follow us on Instagram and TikTok @Vicons Podcast and Twitter @Vicons Pod. See you next time.